Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Diana Leon-Boys about her book titled Elena, Princess of the Periphery, Disney's Flexible Latina Girl. The book was published by Rutgers University Press and is really quite interesting. It takes a look at Disney's quote, kind of first Latina princess. We're going to poke around at sort of what that actually means in practice, because Diana has incredibly helpfully investigated this and gone, well, hang on a second, what is actually happening here with how this was created, how this was marketed, what the actual content is, how this is showing up in other aspects of Disney, like the theme parks. So that really helps us really understand what is actually happening with this character. Diana, thank you so much for being here.
Yes, thank you so much, not only for that lovely introduction, but also for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
It is a pleasure to have you. And I wonder if you could start us off, please, by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book.
Absolutely. So first and foremost, I always like to tell people that I, even though I am within communication studies, I'm a media studies scholar. So nestled within communication, I look at media. My training is from the Institute of the Communications Research at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And it's this phenomenal setting where all of us and the people who continue to be there look at media very seriously from a lot of different angles. And particularly for my work, I'm an intersectional, interdisciplinary, a scholar who's just at the intersection really of a whole bunch of different areas. You know, I look at gender and sexuality, Latina, Latino, Latinx studies, and all of that within communication and media. So mostly, I say mostly, and I kind of hesitate because I mostly focus on popular culture as my sites of analyses, although sometimes, you know, just kind of like peripherally, I will look at news media here and there and sort of tie it into the larger conversation. But I do primarily focus on pop culture to answer questions about how these images and representations are shaping society and vice versa. So I take a lot from Antonio Gramsci's work to look at how the mainstream functions as a terrain of struggle. And within that, I argue that Latinas, Latinos, or Latinxes are used as symbols and tools for larger forces. So I just want to briefly stop there for a second and talk about the term Latinx, Latina, Latino, Latinx. It's one of those terms that I feel like is sometimes used in different ways than what it's actually, how it's actually supposed to be used. It's very different than Latin American. So you'll notice that in some universities, we have Latin American studies, and there's also a department for Latina, Latino, Latinx studies. So primarily Latinx, it refers to, or Latina, Latino, however you choose to say it, whatever term you choose to employ. It refers to people of Latin American descent living in the United States of America. So that's just one thing that I really wanted to make clear, because it's central to my work, and it's my work at large, and central to this book, which of course is the focus of your question. But I just wanted to specifically stop at that point where we address the specificity of location, right, in the United States of America. And so really, that's just kind of the beginning of my research and what I do. Long story short, I ended up doing an independent study during my doctoral program on girls' studies, because I was really interested in delving into the field and the subfield of girls' media studies. And when I was doing this work, when I was putting together an annotated bibliography along with a literature review, I noticed that there really wasn't much work on Latina girls, particularly Latina girls and the media. So that's where I decided I was going to focus the rest of my energies for the remainder of the doctoral program. And, you know, it really happened serendipitously. That very day that I made the decision that I was going to write a dissertation about Latina girls, I had no idea what it was going to be, but I knew it was going to be about Latina girls. That very day, I started seeing a lot of advertisements. I shouldn't call them advertisements. I started seeing a lot of posts on social media from a lot of Latinx actors advertising, this is where I can say advertising this new supposed quote unquote Latina princess. I seriously saw like three or four back-to-back posts by really prominent Latinx actors like Gina Rodriguez and Jaime Camil. And I thought, what is this? Who is this? And really, that's kind of where this project began. As you will notice, that's a lot of that stuff makes up the production chapter. My first case study for this book, those Instagram posts and the labor that the actors provide via their social media platform. So that's kind of where it began. I thought, I want to do my work about Latina girls. I want to look at media. I want to look at children. And once I made those decisions, I saw all of these posts for Elena of Avalor, who was going to be making her debut on Disney Junior that summer. And that's where the project began. I started watching all of the episodes, conducting analyses of these, and then also analyzing other things, which we can talk about in a second, alongside the television series.
What a great introduction to the book in terms of how you got here, but also a bunch of the things that made it into the finished version that I now get to ask you about. So thank you for that lovely start to this. The first thing I'd like to pick up on is, obviously, you mentioned kind of, oh, that leads into my first case study. The book has more than one case study. Can you give us a brief outline of what the three are and how you decided on them?
Yes, of course. So the three case studies that I incorporated into the analysis of Elena of Avalor are a study of the production of the series, a study of the text of the series, and a study of audiences. And I'll delve into all of these briefly here for you. But I think that originally, and I always tell people that, you know, if anybody says, oh, your book about Elena or the book about the princesses, it's a lot more, it's about a lot more than that. And you know this, you've read the book. It's about media industries. It's about Disney. It's about ethnicity. It's about childhood. It's about belonging. It's about citizenship. It's about synergy. So there's so much more than just the princess. And, you know, maybe I shouldn't say just, but there's a lot more than just the actual narrative. So I, you know, for a long time, I've always found it very useful within media studies to conduct a circuit of culture media studies type of analyses for my work. And this is dating back to a study that was done by Duguay and like eight other authors, including Stuart Hall. Maybe it's not eight, seven or eight. And it's the story of the Sony Walkman. So basically this, and for anybody that's listening, who's a media studies person, you know exactly what I'm talking about. It's really a way of conducting research that allows for the story of a media text to come out through various angles, through different nodes, or what the original authors of the text refer to as moments. So different moments of a product, right? I talk about them as nodes in my work. So you essentially look at whether it be a film or a television series or a toy, and you put it in conversation with all of the different things that are happening around that one particular item that relate to it. So if you're analyzing a toy, you put that in conversation perhaps with how the film that it belongs to was produced, or you know, the stories behind the production practices of that film, or, you know, interviews with the producer, and then maybe how this character of the toy comes to life via Disney on Ice shows, for example, right? There's a lot of different angles and layers that you can look at. But for the purposes of my study, I said I want to look at how this is produced, the text, meaning what you actually see on the screen. So for the text analysis, I ended up analyzing the 70 plus episodes, but then I condensed that into the 11 episodes that you see throughout my analysis of the text, just mostly based on the recurring themes that I continue to see. And then finally, the audiences portion, that's when I did my work at the theme park. That's where I thought, I really want to see not only how this storyline, this character, this fictitious universe is produced and how it is represented on the screen, but I also want to see how it comes to life in a theme park setting where there's constant interaction between Disney cast members and Disney guests. So I really wanted to see that dynamic nature the dynamic interaction and put that in conversation with the other two pieces. So the book itself is made up of those three main case studies. But before delving into those three case studies, I just do a brief, and truly it's brief, a very brief overview of Disney, and then also Disney and its relationships to childhood, Latinidad, girlhood, and, you know, taking us all the way from, you know, 1950s, 1940s till the present moment. And I really do mean brief because there are, oh my goodness, such long books that we could delve into about, you know, the Disney, the beginnings of Disney Corporation and Walt's early days. And no, but I do it briefly in one chapter, basically talk about how it's going to feed into the different things that I will be analyzing through the different case studies. And then I actually jump into the case studies about the Elena of Avalor series. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I said, a lot more than a series, right?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's a very helpful sort of overview of the book. And, you know, it worked pretty well in the book. So I think I'm going to do something similar here, if you don't mind, in terms of structure. Mm-hmm. So starting with that idea of the overview, I agree that the point here is not kind of all things Disney, history of Disney, but there is something very helpful to understand about how this fits into Disney's involvement and interaction with Latin America, but also Latinidad, as you very helpfully clarified in your initial answer, to understand kind of the context of this. So can you walk us through a bit of that history even before we get to Elena? And what are the sorts of kind of, by the time we get to Elena, built-in tensions that Disney has around trying to be appealing to Latin America, but also Latinidad, but also Universal?
Yeah, absolutely. So Disney, since the first thing that I can think of that they ever produced that was, you know, Latin American specific, I'm thinking here of 1940s Saludos Amigos, and Los Tres Caballeros, there's not really an acknowledgement about the difference between U.S. Latinidad, which again is specific to folks living in the United States of America, and Latin Americanness and the experience of being a Latin American person living in Latin America, right? There's no distinction on behalf of Disney, right? Disney just kind of assumes that it's the same experience, that it's, you know, the same process. And that's how they kind of run with things, right? I know I'm kind of skipping. I'm not hanging out too much in the early 1940s, but I will go back to that. For example, one of the biggest examples that I always go to is Coco. And Elena too, but we'll talk a lot about Elena in a second. Coco, for example, was advertised, promoted, and put forth as a representation of Latinidad, of Latinxes. And, you know, for those of us that have seen the film, we know that it takes place in Mexico and in the land of the dead. It doesn't take place at all in the US. And originally the story was actually supposed to be about a young boy from Chicago who has to make a trip to Mexico for his grandmother's services. His grandmother just passed. So it was definitely going to require a lot of back and forth, like we see in the actual film, but not necessarily between Land of the Dead and Mexico, more so Chicago and Mexico, and then a little bit of Land of the Dead. Somehow along the way, I don't know the details of this. I'm not privy to this information, but they changed their minds about, you know, where it was going to take place. And they decided that it was going to be a lot more vibrant and full of culture and just visually much more appealing if they did back and forth Mexico and Land of the Dead. So that, to me, I'm always like, oh, that was, we almost had a Latinx representation. We almost had it. But then they switched over to Latin America. Same with Encanto. And just, you know, we keep reproducing Latin America, not we, Disney. Disney keeps reproducing Latin American representations over and over again and claiming them to be Latinx. And there's so much beauty behind the Latin American representations that they put forth, but it's not all encompassing of a very specific US experience of people from Latin American descent living in this country. So one of the things that I did want to say going back to the 1940s, and, you know, all of those, what I and many others would categorize as really offensive portrayals of Latin Americans through those two key films, the Saludos Amigos and the Tres Caballeros, also known as the Good Neighbor films. What Walt and you know, his crew ended up doing was really prominently showcasing Mexico in both of these, even though their attempt was to showcase a vibrant and varied representation of Latin America. And these were, just very briefly to not give you too much of a historical rundown here, these were films that were, they were called Good Neighbor films because they were part of the, you know, Good Neighbor policy. They were part of this agreement that Walt had with the US government at the time to create these films in order to produce or create some kind of goodwill between their quote unquote neighbors to the South in order to basically secure them as allies during the war. So that was a very quick spiel into that. But what you end up seeing through these films is a very prominent representation of Mexico, which was supposed to be, like I said, representation of Latin America at large, because Walt and his crew, when they were doing the research for this, they ended up going to Argentina, Brazil, and Chile to conduct their research. So as you notice, they didn't go to Mexico, at least not for their initial trips. But what they primarily default to is showing Mexico, 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 Mexico. And that's what we see a lot of now. That's what I saw a lot of through Elena, representations that are supposed to be pan Latinx. So they're supposed to represent somehow all 33 plus countries, yet they often fall back on these very stereotypical Mexican markers. What I call this unnamed Mexico. And this is just very similar to what they've been doing since the 1940s. And, you know, maybe it's just a template or a sort of equation that works for them that they know will generate success. So that's really what I saw a lot of happening in Elena of Avalor. But, you know, what I always say is that it's pretty impossible. You can't do both. You can't be universal and specific, right? The main objective is really to secure as many eyeballs as possible. Disney wants to obviously get as many people to go to the theaters or to tune in to their different shows on Disney Plus or to go to their theme parks. So making something very specific is never going to be what sells for them. It's never going to be the most economic risk-averse strategy. So what you find is that it becomes really messy when you're trying to do something that's specific and universal at the same time, right? I mean, it would make sense that it would be really messy. Through Elena of Avalor, Disney uses a lot of markers incorrectly. You know, I noticed this a lot in the production chapter of my work. They, in this infographic that I analyzed, they used a lot of different symbols and things to stand in for other things that just didn't make sense, you know, like giving a male character a traditional role that in Peruvian culture would not be given to a male character and, or to a male person, I should say. And at the same time, this character is holding a drum that has Mayan symbols on it, and Mayan symbols are Mexican, they're not Chilean. So, you know, it's just like this very messy type of representation that we see because Disney's trying to be specific and universal. And that's just, it's really not possible. They're trying to do too many things through this one.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's what they're very much trying to do. So thank you for taking us through that. Is there anything you want to discuss further on that point before I ask you more about the production?
No, you know, oh goodness, I could talk about that infographic that I just briefly mentioned for hours, but really, no, just it just goes down to show that it just goes to show that it's very messy. And I found the messiness not just through the infographic, but also through their corporate social responsibility reports, through the text, and even as we'll talk about later, I'm sure, through the theme park. My goodness, it's so messy.
Yeah, no, it very much is. If we stay on the production process side of things, can you walk us through kind of, if the outcome is messy, sort of what are the inputs that get us there? You talk about mainly three aspects of the production process that Disney uses to try and make this claim that Elena is the first Latina princess. What are these things that Disney's doing to try and get this across?
Yeah. When I actually... The big part of the writing the production chapter was actually dealing with what I saw as a really flexible and malleable type of Latinidad. And this is so funny because it wasn't until many, many drafts later of that chapter and then other chapters that I said, I think I really want to use that for the title of the book, the flexibility. I had originally found that flexibility through an analysis of the production. And then I started noticing that it was in all of the case studies. So I thought, okay, flexibility, it has to be in the title. So I do locate three aspects of Disney's production process that I argue lead to this construction of an authentic quote-unquote Latinidad through Elena. And that first one is that flexibility. And that one, I just want to put flexibility in bold and italicize it and underline it and make it like 25-point font because it just seeps into every other one of the case studies. So this flexible Latinidad that I found in the production parts through the corporate narratives and their corporate social responsibility reports. So the reports that Disney puts out to their investors and their stakeholders annually. And this is something that I also found through, well, like I said, I'll talk about it later, but through all of the different angles and the flexibility in the corporate narratives and the corporate social responsibility reports was basically trying to do that same kind of messy pan Latinidad sort of thing to where there's a few markers from specific Latin, you know, from specific countries, right? But used very messily in order to just basically talk about how they were being, what is the term that they used? How they were being more inclusive or how they were being more sensitive to culture. And at this point, when I was actually analyzing these CSR reports, it was at the time that Coco and Elena were both gaining a lot of momentum. And of course, Coco a lot more than Elena. And they kind of use the two interchangeably in their reports, whether it be through narratives or also visually in the images that they would put forth in these. Some were as much as 10 pages in length, some were over 50 pages in these 10 to 50-ish page reports. And then the second aspect or the second layer that I find in the production process and Disney's production process of the series and the narrative is the use, the very, very prominent use of Latinx talent and Latinx actors to promote the series' Latinidad. And this is what I briefly mentioned through that little little snippet of how I came across this research project when I talked about truly just scrolling. I was scrolling my Instagram and I was like, whoa, 1, 2, 3, 4. I think that day I had noticed 4 of the celebrities that I followed. And I don't follow a lot of celebrities. So I feel like this was pretty significant. 4 of them, all Latinx, were posting about on their personal social media platforms. They were posting about the significance of this supposed Disney's first Latina princess. So that's actually how I got into the analysis of the labor of the actors, because what I argue, and I put forth a few terms, you know, sometimes it feels weird to like coin these terms and to put forth like new terminology for how to analyze things. But I call it managed prosumerism. And I also talk about the labor of re-promotion within managed prosumerism, which is just basically the part of the production chapter where I talk about how these celebrities, this talent, right? Is very strategically marketing the television series, the products, the park experiences, all of that that relate to Elena of Avalor through their personal Instagram pages. And thus, they're performing additional labor on behalf of the Walt Disney Company. Even Latinx talent who are not part of the voice actors for the Elena of Avalor series. And this is something that I found was very unique to the Latinx folks, the Latinx actors. And, you know, it would make sense, right? Because they're promoting and putting forth this new series that is supposed to speak to their people, right? Who they are, their culture. And this is something that I did not see cross over into any other populations. It was just limited to the Latinx actors, the Latinx talent. And this is, you know, it's a part where I have to do a little bit of speculation in my work because I don't have all of the behind the scenes info, right? So I have to, you know, make assumptions in terms of how staged these posts seem. do they seem like there's a lot of posts that sound identical? Like what is Disney's involvement in this? Is there any involvement? Is this all just coming from, you know, the talent themselves? Are these posts pressured? Are these posts paid? I don't have the answers to that, but I can tell you that it is additional labor that seems to be put on the shoulders of these particular actors, these television or film stars that are Latinx, who are promoting and really shining light on this series. And sometimes I like to say whether they want to or not, right? A lot of what I talk about in terms of the re-promotion is these young children from the television series Stuck in the Middle, who are pretty much just used over and over again for Disney synergistic purposes to promote Latinidad or Hispanic Heritage Month, because really they are the only live action kiddos that Disney has to put forth all of the stuff that they try to showcase during that month. They're all coming from that Stuck in the Middle series. So, you know, Disney is using them and using the talent. And I say use in terms of like synergistic capabilities, right? Disney will recycle their characters from the screen to toys, to theme parks, you name it, right? So that is something that I find there through that second production practice. That one is specific to actors and social media pages and the labor that's performed on these platforms, which I also like to think is just a very interesting way to look at synergy, because it takes on a sort of ethnic perspective that crosses or takes us outside of Disney. And now it's just become more of like an ethnic type of synergy, something that I'm still thinking through a lot and perhaps we'll continue to work through for future projects, because there's a lot that can be explored there through other series, films, et cetera. And then the last little layer that I find in the production process, this is again, the second chapter of the book, is that Disney uses Elena as a way to showcase their ethnic and culture specific components through both the CSR, which I've already talked about, in the Flexible Latinidad, the corporate social responsibility, as well as through their partnership with Girl Scouts USA. So there was a very prominent partnership between the conglomerate and Girl Scouts USA for the introduction of this princess, for her debut at the theme parks, and also for the debut on the screen. There were a lot of partnerships there, which I think allowed the company to really push beyond just the ethnic element and also seep into all of the girl power narratives and the girl power discourses and all of that post-feminist stuff that really is highlighted through Girl Scouts USA. But Elena there in that third little stage, that third layer that I uncovered in the production is pretty much front and center in terms of all of the ways in which the conglomerate for about 3 or 4 years promoted how they engage with ethnicity, with culture, any of that stuff, you name it, diversity. And then as well as how they bridged those categories, how they united those categories with girlhood and with girl power, particularly with those girl power narratives. But yeah, those are pretty much the three different layers that I uncovered through the production practices.
No, and thank you for taking us through them. Taking seriously the let's make it in bold and italics and size 25 font word flexibility, can you introduce us to your continuum of flexibility and perhaps an example for each of the different stages within it?
Yes, of course. Flexibility is it's an interesting one just in general. Before I jump into the continuum, I just want to say that last week, I had the pleasure and the privilege of talking to a graduate seminar about the book, and somebody brought up the fact that before they read the book, before they hopped into it and even knew anything about this, and this was somebody that is not in media studies, they said, I thought this flexibility was going to be awesome and just so positive, because when I think of flexibility, this person said, I think about somebody being flexible, somebody being able to go with the flow, or somebody who's physically flexible, right? Somebody who can do the splits and somebody who can stretch, touch their toes and all these things. And I thought, oh, no, I use flexibility a little bit differently. I said, I see exactly where you're coming from, but I talk about flexibility in terms of being a little bit too ambitious, right? I use the metaphor of that rubber band. You're just stretching it and you're trying to make different shapes out of it. If you stretch it too far or too hard, it's going to snap and it's going to hurt, which is, you know, I think a lot of the things that I uncover in the book. But what I ended up doing for the textual analysis chapter was, I don't know the exact number, but after a lot of drafts, I came back and I just was not happy with what things were looking like, because I had 70 plus episodes that I was analyzing and trying to categorize. And a lot of what I was saying just seemed so repetitive and boring. I was saying, this scene is stereotypical. This episode is stereotypical. This other episode is not so much. This other one, wow, it blew me out of the water. And I just thought, it just seems so simplistic, what I'm saying. It seems so black and white. And there are so many different layers between the two binaries that I'm making here, between it's a stereotype, it's not a stereotype. So what I ended up doing after draft and draft and draft and draft is that I thought, you know what? I think it actually started out with a drawing. Yeah, it was a little drawing, kind of like a spectrum, which then turned into a continuum, where I categorized and put all of these different episodes along the continuum, along a continuum. And I was categorizing the episodes or the scenes or the moments according to weight or level of flexibility. And when I talk about that, I'm really drawing on a lot of Stuart Hall's work when he talks about the weightlessness that certain representations carry. So when I think about what a weightless representation means, I'm thinking about something like Saludos Amigos or Los Tres Caballeros that have the bandidos and the ay ay ays and people with sombreros and guns and, you know, the dancing ladies around the mariachis. That's what I think about in terms of weightless. So the spectrum goes all the way from weightless flexibility to transformational flexibility. And it has four different categories. I have the weightless flexibility, ambiguous flexibility, hybrid flexibility, and transformational flexibility. And before I hop into each one of those and just briefly say how I'm operationalizing them and how, like, give a few examples, I just really want to note that when I developed this, I was really hopeful that other folks who are doing similar work could use these in their own analyses of media texts, and hopefully in their own analyses of media texts that showcase or focus on non-dominant populations. So whether it be somebody looking at LGBTQ plus representations or representations of differently abled people in the media, I'm really hoping that people can use this, can adapt it. Hopefully they can add other types of flexibilities to this. You know, I'm just really hopeful that maybe I will see that out there. I've seen it already in some of my grad students' works, but I'm like, all right, I want to see it in the work of other people that don't work so closely with me. But basically, like I just said, the weightless flexibility are those super stereotypical moments, right? The moments that media makers probably think that audiences are familiar with. If you put in, what is it? Like, for example, a character of a maid with an accent, like a Spanish sounding accent. You know, the media makers probably think that it's going to resonate with audiences and they're going to recognize that person as a Latina, right? Very weightless. Then the ambiguous flexibility, that's moving towards the right of the spectrum, towards the end, is really what I found. I found it through the series, but then I started thinking of moments outside of the series, which I also talk about when I'm introducing the spectrum in that chapter of the book. It's when media makers include words or, you know, places, whatever it is that sound authentic. And I'm saying authentic in quotes, whatever that means for the media makers, but there's no really known origin or any known place, right? So the example that I bring up in the book for before I delve into the series, because in the series, there's a lot of examples of the ambiguous flexibility, but is that little piece that Ángela Valdivia writes about in Beatriz at Dinner, the film with Salma Hayek in it, where Salma Hayek's character says that she's from Tlatelolco, but this isn't a place. She says, this is where I'm from. I think it's Tlatelolchi or something like that. And it's actually an Aztec mythical figure. It's not a place. So media makers use this authentic, in quotes again, sounding word to stand in for something that it's not what it actually is. She's an Aztec mythical figure, but they're using it to mean, I don't know if she meant it was a city or it was a country, who knows? But that's where she says that she's from. And we see a lot of those instances. I see a lot of those instances within Elena of Avalor, which again points to that messiness. And then moving further along to the right of the spectrum is the hybrid flexibility, which is just a mix of a lot of different sort of specific markers. So you have different signifiers from different types of Latinidades. And oftentimes what you see here is that Latinidad is named, but often in a way that just does not make sense. It doesn't add up. So I talk about it through the example of the Jewish Latina princess, which we see only in one full episode and then sprinkled in a couple of episodes later beyond that. But she's speaking Yiddish in the episode. And I'm not Jewish. So, you know, there's a lot there that I wouldn't be able to tap into. But after talking to some folks and also reading a lot of responses online, a lot of people were just saying how it didn't really make sense. This incorporation would have looked much more authentic, again, in quotes, had she been speaking Ladino instead. And you see a lot of that, not just through the Jewish princess, but that's a good example of it from the series. And then also you see this a lot when it comes to representations of Native Americans on television, for example. You know, you might see characters with markers of Plains tribes, like the beads that they use or their dress, but then they speak Navajo. And if you're not a Native American person, it just doesn't register, right? You wouldn't know how messy that is. And that typically these folks would not be speaking Navajo. So, this is one of those things that I saw coming up over and over again in this series. And then finally, the transformational flexibility. This is where I talk about the true moments of rupture, you know, either never before or rarely seen representations, moments where if you are part of this population, if you are part of this non-dominant group, you might think, wow, there's so many possibilities through this representation. I don't usually see myself in this way. And one of the ones that I always come back to, even though it's not fully transformational, is the character of Isabel, which is Elena of Avalor's younger sister. She is this brilliant prodigy child who's an inventor. She's a STEM genius. And she really is the one that solves most of the pickles that Elena gets into. Her tween sister solves all of these problems for her. And it does fall in line with a lot of more recent representations of Latinidad, especially Latina girls, where they're showcased as these brilliant overachievers. We've been seeing a lot more of this post 2015. But those are the types of representations that I, for example, never had growing up as a child. I never saw a Latina on television leading science projects or going to a college class or enrolling in an institute for college people. I was going to say kids, college students at the age of 12. I never saw that. So for me, those are some of the examples of more of that transformational flexibility where I hope we can continue to see more of an expansion there.
Yeah, no, I think that those examples illustrate it very well and kind of make that point that you were saying at the beginning of like flexibility isn't inherently a good thing. Like that doesn't necessarily mean that sort of, oh, you can touch your toes and everything's great. There's a lot more complexity and nuance here to it. So thank you for taking us through the continuum and also the part about kind of how you developed it, I think is interesting as well. In that answer, you obviously have already discussed a bit sort of what are some of the stereotypes that are being reinforced in Elena, as well as some that are being expanded. Are there other stereotypes or aspects of girlhood that we want to discuss in that context?
Yeah, you know, one of the main things that I sort of see playing out again in the series is the castle and Avalor itself and all that it stands for is central, of course, to the series. It's central to the storyline and to the character development and all of that. And obviously she's royalty, so there's a class marker there. And as you stray from the castle, the further and further you get, we see more and more of those stereotypical representations of Latinidad. We even see them with like skin color. And then as a lot lighter, and then the folks who are like the peasants who live outside of Avalor, they're dark, they have thicker accents. It's the recreation of a lot of those moments that we see, that we have seen year after year after year, in not just Disney, in media representations at large. So really there's a lot of back and forth in the series. I think that it's a huge mix of, you know, expanding existing stereotypes, but also creating a space for new versions of girlhood to unfold. Of course, Elena falls in line with much more modern princesses, right? The ones that don't need a male counterpart to save them, the ones who can save themselves and at the end of the day, you know, be responsible for their own successes in the world. But it's still, there's a lot of continuity there. And much more of the continuity that I see is not really in relation to gender or that femininity, at least in the series, but the continuity there falls much more in line with how media makers represent Latinidad, or how they often conflate Latinidad and Latin Americanness, right? It's still very messy, very reliant on Mexico as a stand-in for all Latinidad and Latin Americanness. And then, like I mentioned briefly, that the colorism there and the accents and all of that that we very prominently see throughout the series. Yeah, but I think that's just, you know, those are just a few of the, you know, what I wanted to say about the stereotypes and whether they were expanding or kind of, you know, going back or reverting back to older formulas.
Mm. No, thank you. That's useful to have in the conversation. I want to talk about theme parks now. I admit that this might have been my favorite of the case studies, mostly, I think, because of what you actually found. Like, it's incredibly stark, or at least I found it to be incredibly stark. So obviously there's two major theme parks. There's California and Florida. They have loads of differences in terms of the Disney side of things. They also have loads of differences in terms of like relationships with Latinidad and relationships with Latin America and relationships with Spanish and all sorts of things kind of beyond the parks themselves. Can you do a bit of compare and contrast for us? To what extent was seeing Elena the princess in the Disney theme park kind of, you know, Disney paints this idea of once you're in the park, you're in some fantastical other land. You're not in California anymore. You're not in Florida anymore. Was Elena in both instances the same?
No. And she was very different. And this is honestly, and not that it's not my favorite chapter per se. I don't have a favorite one, but this is the one that after getting home and, you know, putting all my thoughts together and jotting everything down, I was the most surprised by all of my findings from the theme parks. This is going to be a hard question because I've presented about this chapter for an hour. So I'm just like, I need to condense this. I need to really get good at condensing this. But basically there's a ton of differences in, oh, I wish I could go back into my memory of that. I have bullets on some of the slides that I presented on. But Elena in California, the most prominent thing that came out through my observations was her continued use of the Spanish language as she was communicating with guests. So this actually ended up coming up organically during my first visit to the Anaheim park, because I conducted my field work in Anaheim 11 months prior to my field work in Orlando in Florida. So California, Anaheim, I get there and one of the first instances where I ever heard Elena communicating with one of the other park guests, she was talking to them in Spanish, completely in Spanish, about their visit, about their niece, about all of these different things. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is so cool. I didn't even know Disney characters could talk in other languages at the park. This is awesome. So then every time that I would go visit the princess, when it was my turn, right, you get in line behind a whole bunch of people that are waiting to have pictures taken and have autographs signed. And every single time that I engaged with these different cast members who were playing the part, I would just talk to her in Spanish and we'd have conversations, very, very superficial conversations about our attire and what I was going to do at Disney, right? As you would imagine, or if you've been to a theme park, you know what these conversations are like. They were all in Spanish. So I'm 11 years fast forward, taking the trip to my second part of the ethnographic work. And I get to Florida and I'll step back a second. I was surprised because in Florida, Elena has a very prominent position. She holds a very prominent position at the Magic Kingdom. Whereas in California, her time to interact with guests and to be floating around is very minimal. And in my chapter, I talk about how they strip Elena of a lot of the times that she actually has available to meet with audiences. So fast forward, Florida. I'm just shocked by how much time they give Elena to be at the park interacting with guests and by the fact that she has such a prominent position next to Cinderella inside the hall. So I think, wow, this is huge. Like she's front and center. She's inside the hall. She's next to Cinderella, like the iconic, right? Number one Disney princess, Cinderella. So I think, wow, this is huge. My goodness. And then I start realizing that there's a lot of interesting things going on here. She talks about herself as an outsider. This is not her kingdom. So she talks about the kingdom where she's from, what they do in that kingdom. And the most prominent finding here was linguistic as well. Elena was not allowed, and I will use the word allowed because it was all very scripted. You could tell that all of the different cast members or actresses who were playing this part, they were very, very scripted. They all delivered pretty much exactly the same lines. Anytime either myself or any of the other guests would ask her a question in Spanish, or they would ask her if she spoke Spanish, she would say, yes, I do. But she would either say, I'm working hard, I'm practicing my English here, or my grandmother told me that in Cinderella's kingdom, we need to speak in English, or you know, practicing English or learning a different language takes a lot of work. So that's what I'm going to do here. And she at no point in time did she communicate with any of the park guests in Spanish. And I saw quite a few women playing this role. So the lines that they uttered time and time again were all very similar, which is why I say that it's a very strategic choice. It's scripted. It's, of course, part of the training that these people have to go through. But I will note that I don't live at the parks. I don't go there every day. So the conversations could look different now. Or maybe had I gone 3 weeks later, it would have looked drastically different. If I were to speculate, though, I would say that maybe in California, she's no longer speaking Spanish. I'm not sure, though. I have not been back to California actually since this work. I have been back to the Florida parks because I now live in Florida, but I have not visited any of the California parks since then. And the reason why I do say this is because living in Florida, I've actually had a chance to interact with many people who are either currently cast members or whose family members are cast members, or maybe they were cast members previously. I've had some of these students even in my classes. I've heard through a couple of them, and then some of them even sent me to some links that say that at Walt Disney World, you cannot communicate in any language other than English. So maybe that's a little bit of what was going on at the Florida park. I'm not sure why those rules didn't translate at the time to California. Maybe they do now. I'm not entirely sure of that, but the linguistic stuff is really, that was the most prominent thing that came up during my research at both of the parks. And I think maybe that's where I'll stop for that part, because like I said, I could talk about the theme park chapter for probably well over an hour, but I will spare you that.
Well, no, I've personally found that to be the most interesting finding as well. So I'm glad you highlighted that. As you mentioned, obviously, you haven't been to the California park since you wrote this, but you have, I believe, been to the Florida one. Is there anything further you want to tell us about kind of what you've discovered there since this book came out?
Yeah, so she's still there. And as you'll note from my conclusion, I say, oh, I think they're going to slowly start phasing her out of the parks, right? I say, the series is over, you know, it's time. We're seeing her less and less at the parade. So I'm sure they're going to take her out of that prominent position by Cinderella, right? No. She is still very much inside the Royal Hall. Fairy Tale Hall. I get the names confused. I think in California, it's the Royal Hall. And here in Florida, it's the Fairy Tale Hall. But I think what's happened now, and I haven't gone in almost a year, to be honest with you, but my daughter actually went recently, about a month or so ago. I think now they frame it as Cinderella and Guest Princess. And what I have heard from a current cast member, who is not a student of mine, but somebody else that I know here from Florida, is that what they'll do for both sides of the hall is that on one side, they will have, on both sides, they have a white one of the traditional, back to Renaissance era princess, one of the traditional white princesses, and they'll couple her with a non-white princess. And if you think about it, there's not a lot to choose from. So Tiana is pretty much always on the other side of the hall. But next to Cinderella, I think sometimes they just take turns between the few, amongst the few that they have to choose from, the few non-white princesses that they have. And, of course, they can't bring in Mirabel from Encanto there because she's not technically a princess and you have to be a princess to be in the fairy tale hall. So, yeah, that's honestly the most it's fascinating to me that she is still inside the hall next to Cinderella most of the time, right? At least when I've gone. And then anytime I know somebody's going, and there's a lot of people here that go pretty often, I'll say, hey, if you're around the hall, would you mind just letting me know who's next to Cinderella? And, either sometimes people send me pictures or they'll say, hey, it's Elena or whatnot. But I'm just very surprised that that she's still there. And maybe it has to do with the fact that there are not many non-white princesses to place alongside Cinderella. I don't know. But that was definitely a shock to me initially because I thought, oh no, I wrote in my conclusion that they're going to phase her out and she is still there. I think it maybe opens up the space to have other conversations about what the future looks like for Disney and its inclusion of Latinidad or Latin Americanness.
Well, in fact, I'd like to ask you about another thing kind of on that, in that vein, since Elena finished. Obviously, since you wrote the book, we've had Encanto, we've had Wish. Encanto especially got massive amounts of attention. How do you, particularly kind of having done all this research and in-depth investigation, do you have a comment about those and their relation to Disney?
Yeah, well, they're both surprising and not, mostly not surprising. With Encanto, I loved that we were able to see the specificity of Colombia shine through, but it's also still set in Latin America, very, very specifically Latin America, which Disney is proud of and puts forth and advertises, but they also advertise as Latinx, as Latinidad, which as you all know now from listening to my little spiel at the beginning, there it's not the same, right? The experience of a person living in Colombia from Colombian descent, who's, their family has lived there their whole lives, is not the same as the experience of a person living in, I don't know, a random place in like Norman, Oklahoma, let's say, from Colombia. They're not in the majority, linguistically, they're not in the, so there's a lot of things there that you can see, of course, are not the same. So while it was beautiful and colorful and still fell in line with a lot of the same sort of generalized ways in which we see Latinxes and Latin Americans in general being represented, it was still very specific to a Latin American country. But I also found a lot of moments of transformational flexibility within the movie, especially along the lines of the discussions of mental health and intergenerational trauma, and even through the character of Luisa. My goodness, I just thought that was just such a beautiful character that I never saw anyone, whether it was in animated form or in live action form, like that when I was growing up. So I thought, oh, this is really neat. Of course, it's a mixed bag, right? And then Wish. I don't know what was going on there. That was, if we say that Elena of Avalor is messy, I don't even know how to categorize. I don't even know what it was supposed to be. Was it supposed to be a very vague mishmashy sort of Latinx, sort of just ethnic other type of representation? I don't know. I'm still trying to make sense of that one. I've only seen it once. And I thought, what was that supposed to be? So now I think what I want to go back and do is like maybe look at some of the stuff that has been put out in terms of the production side of things on how they advertised it. Because I've seen it through various outlets advertised as Latinx. But I'm like, what? No, what was that? What even was that? So, you know, just very mishmashy and just pretty consistent with mishmashiness of non-white animated representations as part of the Disney family. So, yeah, I'm sure that hopefully there's other brilliant people doing research on that. But I, you know, maybe I might stop at that one viewing. I don't know that I'll watch it again, in all honesty.
Fair enough. If other people hopefully will research that, what might you be working on now that this book is done?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm actually working on the second book, but it's a team effort. I'm editing a really awesome collection of chapters on quinceañeras. I'm doing it with Professor Angela Valdivia and Professor Jillian Baez. And we are writing about quinceañeras in the media. We are joined by a team of, I believe, 12. I think we have 12 chapters, 13 maybe, who are writing about quinceañeras as, oh my goodness, from so many different angles, whether it's like quinceañeras specific, like in the media, how we see these representations, to much more like layer types of analyses in terms of like quinceañera dances, quinceañera dance choreographers, queer quinceañeras, the cinquentañera trend now that we've seen a lot of times on social media where it's like 50-year-old women who are celebrating their quinceañera. And for those of you that don't know, a quinceañera is kind of the equivalent of the Sweet 16 for a lot of Latin American people or U.S. Latinxes. It's a celebration of a girl's 15th birthday, which is supposed to symbolize, you know, one of those coming of age types of moments where you mark the transition from girlhood to womanhood. And they can be incredibly elaborate or they can be much more modest and smaller. But we are putting together an edited collection on quinceañeras with a media angle from a media studies approach, which should be out, I want to say mid-2025, but don't hold me to that. It'll be out soon, though. And that is, it's been very exciting to work with such a phenomenal team and to just get all of these brilliant essays from such wonderful contributors.
Well, that sounds like a very fun project. Best of luck finishing that. And thank you for the sneak preview. Always a fun way to end. But of course, while you are finishing that off, listeners can read the book we've been discussing titled Elena, Princess of the Periphery, Disney's Flexible Latina Girl, published by Rutgers University Press. Diana, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for the invite. It was a pleasure.